Take your Bibles, go with me this morning, the book of Esther, chapter 5. Esther, chapter 5. While you're turning over there, some of you will be able to identify with me. When I was a kid, we used to play a game, and we've done this with our children also. It was a game. We might find ourselves on a long trip somewhere. We're just sitting around a restaurant waiting on the food to come. And we would draw off several little lines which represented letters in a word or maybe a phrase. We would take that and then we would draw out a little line going up and a line over to the side of that. Anybody know what game I'm talking about here? It's a game we called Hangman. The title of the message this morning is A Game of Hangman. If you think about that game, I was thinking about it a little bit. The way it works is you'd have a phrase on there. It's kind of like a kid's version of Wheel of Fortune, I guess. You'd have a word or phrase there. And as it was spelled out, the letters, you would guess a letter. If you got the letter right, they'd put the letter in the little over the line there in that little block. And then you would look, and if you got one wrong, they would take and draw a little portion like the head of the hangman there. And if you got the word before the guy had all of his body parts on there, you got to live. If you didn't, then he was hung there. It's kind of a morbid game when you think about it. But the tension builds. It's an exciting thing, and we always enjoy playing hangman. Well, today, we're returning to our story in the book of Esther, and you can see, just like that little game, the tension's starting to mount again, but this is not a kiddie game of hangman. This is a real game where a guy is setting himself up. You might call it a high-stakes game of hangman, and we're going to see today that Haman is going to be the one that's going to build the gallows. But it's going to turn out that he's eventually going to die himself on the gallows that he builds. Now, I want to begin with a very quick poll here today, and I think you'll see where I'm going with this very quickly. I wonder how many of you here today are here this morning and you're facing some kind of difficult challenge. I wonder how many people today are facing some kind of struggle in their life. It could be a health problem. It might be a problem with your finances. It might be with your family. It could be your work schedule and maybe your job that is on the line at this point. Maybe it's something to do with your church. Maybe someone you love very dearly. I wonder how many of us here today have come with some kind of problem today. If you're like that, you have a problem today, I'm going to ask you to stand. I'm going to ask you to stand to your feet for just a moment. Now, the most likely when we start looking at this, I got to thinking, I thought from leaky roofs to arthritis to bald tires, misbehaving kids, everyone around us, we all have some kind of problems. Now, you can go ahead and have a seat. I'm not going to make that. Some of you, I know your knees aren't good enough. You don't want to stand. But the truth of the matter is we all face problems right now. I mean, our church this morning, to get news like we just got, that's hard, that's heavy. Do you see God orchestrating the service and the music this morning? I mean, I sat there and with tears in my eyes listening to what the choir was singing, and I saw some of the choir members even struggling a little bit as you think about it. When the answer goes beyond what you can see, when you don't understand the purpose of His plan, in the presence of the King, bow the knee. That's where you have to find yourself, saying there's something much bigger than that. Friday, we were at lunch and got a phone call from some friends of ours that, in a former ministry up in Muncie, Indiana, that 32-year-old girl, 32-year-old young lady, she was a senior in the youth group when I was there as a youth pastor. Their family, very, very faithful, this 32-year-old woman was shot by her husband. Family very faithful in the church, both of them graduates of our Christian school up there, going through marital problems, 4-year-old child out in the car at the time when this happened. That's hard to get over, those kinds of things that are hanging over your head at some time, some kind of problem. The book of Esther, you'll recall, there was a problem. There was a major problem. You'll recall the people of Abraham, the Jews, had been basically given a death sentence. It was going to be about a year away, but they're going to be put to death in a mass holocaust because of the pride of one man by the name of Haman. it was a very, very real problem because Mordecai, this Jew there that was the adopted father, the cousin, but the adopted father of Esther, refused to bow down before Haman. As a result of that, you can see this tremendous tension that is building there. But Mordecai, to go back to where we were last week, challenges his daughter, his cousin, that's kind of his adopted daughter, challenges her to go before the king. She's been given a position of authority there, or a position of recognition there. I don't know how much authority she had, but recognition as queen. And so Queen Esther is being challenged to go now before the king, but she had not been in his presence for 30 days. It was a very weighty proposition, a very dangerous possibility right now of even if the king, if she goes in his presence and he's in a bad mood, then the king could have her executed on the spot. Now, Mordecai, though, recognized something very, very interesting here, and that is God's providence was at work. Now, as we've worked our way through this book, we've seen several times the chief character of the book of Esther is who? It's God. Now, God is the chief character, even though he's not even mentioned in this book anywhere, but you see his providence on every page. You see how God is orchestrating and working out the timing, and even though his name's not there, he's behind the scenes somewhere in the shadows, and he's fitting all the pieces of that puzzle together. You recall we said providence is the hand of God in the glove of history. And so God is working, and we've seen that even here this morning. I believe it's not an accident things have happened the way they've happened. God is providentially at work. Now, Haman has tricked the king into making a declaration again that all of the Jews in the kingdom are going to be destroyed. That's going to be devastating news to millions of Jews. And again, I want you to put yourself in the shoes of those Jews, or in their sandals, let's put it that way. But put yourself in their position and realize that these were people just as much as you are a person here today. They were real. We're not talking about a fairy tale. This isn't just some kind of fictitious story. This was a very real event, and all of a sudden they're faced with a very real prospect. They can't run and hide anywhere. The kingdom of Persia at this time covers from India all the way over. It's almost the entire known world. Where are they going to go? Very, very weighty circumstances there. The day of execution's about a year away, but Mordecai tells Esther that she shouldn't find any comfort in the fact that she was in the palace. She was still a Jew. And he pointed out to her the fact was still unknown to anyone else there. She was still a Jew. And he reminded her that if she spoke up and said something to the king, she very well may lose her life. But if she didn't do anything, she surely would lose her life. It was going to happen. And so Esther, Queen Esther, calls for a prayer meeting at the time, and she wants them to fast and pray. She's been challenged that she was put in this position providentially for such a time as this, as we saw last time in chapter 4. She calls them to fast and pray for 3 days, and she's gone to God in prayer. And up to that point in her life, we can safely assume she's probably lived a life of a pretty easy life, other than the fact that she lost her parents. She'd lived in a fairly easy life. And of course, now living in the palace, she's living an easy life now, but she's going to have to put all that on the line. Scripture states very clearly, to whom much is given, much is required. You know, a lot of times we want to be in a place of influence. A lot of times we want to be in a place of power. We want to be thrust into a position sometimes, and we get in that position, we don't realize what really comes with that position is responsibility. And responsibility, the expectations to rise above and to stand out, and she's going to have to make that choice. You know, I got to thinking about some of the problems that we face in our lives. Sometimes we are unsure. We grow unsure about what to do. We have fear in our lives. How are we going to react? So many times there are not these clear-cut choices to be made. Times sometimes where we have to hesitate. Say, okay, what do we do? What direction do we take? And we think about it. If we make the wrong decision, this is going to be not just a little wrong decision. This is going to be a wrong decision that's going to affect everything. You all have been there. Major decisions have to be made. You know, sometimes what happens is we want that word of assurance. We want that guarantee of success before we choose. We ask for maybe some sign from heaven. Lord, am I marrying the right person? You see, if you marry the wrong person, that's pretty major, isn't it? And some of you know that. Is this the right home to purchase for our family? Is this college going to take me where I want to go? Do I really want to remarry? Should I really take on this new challenge? Should I venture into this new business? Should I retire now? Do I really want to take this gamble with my life savings? Is this the church God wants me to be a part of? Should I go and speak to my boss about this issue? See, this is practical, what we're talking about today. In each of these situations, countless others were looking for maybe some measure of success, some kind of promise, some kind of confirmation from God that what we are doing is right, because we want to come to the end of the day and know that we were successful. We don't come to problems in life and not a single one of us comes to a problem and say, boy, I sure hope I fail. That's not the way we approach it. We want to be successful. For the Christian, let me reassure you and remind you, and I hope that if you take notes, you'll write this down today. For the Christian, success has to be defined correctly. Success is very simply defined as this. Success is coming to the end of your life having fulfilled God's will for your life. It's that simple. You want to come to God's will in your life, and you know at the end of the day that you were faithful, you were obedient, and you accomplished exactly what He set out for you to do. So success for the Christian is coming to the end of your life having fulfilled God's will for your life. Nothing more, nothing less. Mordecai tells Esther, maybe, just maybe, this is your purpose. You're here for such a time as this. Well, I want us to read our text today and look at this from Esther chapter 5. We're going to see, again, establishing the setting here in the first few verses. And then we're going to see what I think will be some characteristics that are setting you up for a great fall if you're here today, because you may be planning a game of hangman that you didn't realize. We're going to get to that in just a moment. But let's establish the setting by looking at the first 8 verses. The Bible says, "Now it came to pass on the third day that Esther put on her royal apparel and stood in the inner court of the king's house over against the king's house, and the king sat upon his royal throne in the royal house over against the gate of the house." Now, he had a lot of houses and gates and all that, as you can see from that verse there. But what happens is Esther puts on her royal apparel, she gets herself all fixed up, and she goes over and she stands at the entrance where the king can see her. Now, we know Esther was a very beautiful lady. We know Esther was wearing her very best, and there she waits for the invitation of the king. Now, let me add something for you here, ladies, that might be of help to some of you here today. If you want something from your husband, if you want to get his attention, let me tell you what to do. Take off that old robe that you've been wearing for 30 years. Take off those old ratty slippers. Fix yourself up a little bit. Get yourself with your best clothes on and get your husband in a good mood. And now just maybe he might listen to you. See, something practical right here at the beginning. We see what happens in verse 2. "It was so, when the king saw Esther, the queen, standing in the court, that she obtained favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. So Esther drew near and touched the top of the scepter. And there she stands," and I can almost see the picture as the light reflects off of her. She's absolutely gorgeous, and the king sees her, and when he does, he just flips and says, "Come to Papa." You know, that's what this is. It's 30 days, you know, it's been a while. Come on. And so he swept off his feet. Remember, he was attracted to her to start with, and for some reason, I don't know, the affairs of state or whatever were keeping him from the attention of his wife, but now he sees her and he starts realizing why he was attracted to her in the first place, and he's like, "Come on over here." She touches the royal scepter, which means that she has been accepted here. Then the king said in verse 3, "Then said the king unto her, What wilt thou, Queen Esther, and what is thy request? It shall be given, or even given thee, to half of the kingdom." What's your request? He says this. This is basically a phrase here, a figure of speech, which is saying, "Anything you want, Esther, I'm going to give to you. He's basically issuing her a blank check. And so He's asking her for that, and she's going to ask for something very unique. She's going to say, I want to have a banquet, and I want Haman and you both to be a part of this. Look at verse 4. And Esther answered, if it seem good unto the king, let the king and Haman come this day unto the banquet that I have prepared for him. Verse 5, then said the king said, cause Haman to make haste that he may do as Esther hath said. So the king and Haman came to the banquet that Esther had prepared. Now it was a special honor in those days to be invited to a banquet. If you've ever been invited to a banquet of a special, maybe high-ranking officials, I always enjoy it whenever I get the opportunity, like Mr. Sturgill and I did a few months ago, to go down to Columbia and eat with your legislators and have breakfast with them and to meet and talk. And I've done that through the years when Joanna and I got to go up to D.C. and meet with some of the senators and congressmen up there and basically address questions and answers of things that are going on politically in today's society. And it's always a special honor for that. So Haman gets word that he's been invited to a meal that the queen has specifically asked that he be a part of. Now, can you imagine how he must feel at this time? Now, he doesn't know what's going on in the background right now. He's so self-centered, everything's about him. But he swells up with pride at this moment, and he swells up and he thinks, I'm really moving up. I'm really moving to this place of power here. So they come to the banquet in verse 6, and the king reiterates his request. Verse 6, he says, and the king said unto Esther at the banquet of wine, what is thy petition? And it shall be granted thee, and what is thy request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be performed. Then answered Esther and said, my petition and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my petition and to perform my request, let the king and Haman come to the banquet that I shall prepare for them, and I will do tomorrow as the king has said. So she's saying, okay, what we're going to do, this is what we were having a while back. We had the meeting to plan a meeting. Remember, we had that discussion. Let's have a meeting to figure out when we're going to have a meeting. This is basically what's happened here. We're going to have a banquet, but this banquet today is to talk about the banquet we're going to have tomorrow. But tomorrow, we're really going to get to the issue there. So she's kind of delaying the matter, and I don't know if she was a little bit nervous or what was going on, but the indication is she had a definite plan. She had a definite strategy. She'd been fasting and praying for 3 days. God had probably given her some kind of a course of action here. So there's a timing issue involved here. And I think that there's one of the reasons for the delay here, is that timing is very important in life. You know, folks, there is a time to make a decision. There is an appropriate time to do something that needs to be done. But sometimes we can be too hasty. It wasn't the right timing for her to just go lay it on the line right now. Our tendency sometimes is to go ahead and let Haman have it. Right? Our counsel to Esther might have been, let him have it right now. Pull the walls down on this wretch. Let him know what's going on. But if you're not careful, sometimes you can jump the gun. Well, there's also a place issue involved here. Probably in the first banquet, they were in an area where there were a lot of people. She wants Haman to be in a place where there are not a lot of people, so there'll be no one to come and rescue him. She wants to have him in a place where he'll be totally caught off guard. So there's a timing issue. There's probably a place issue. But there's also a providence issue here. And this is what we've been stressing. And again, the great theme of the book here, the providence of God. And again, even though the name of God's not mentioned in any of these 10 chapters in this book, you see his providence all throughout that. The hand of God in the glove of history. So he's working. Something else has to take place. Something else has to be put together as a piece of this puzzle as we're putting it together. God is deliberately moving slowly in order to move forward. Have you ever thought about how God does that sometimes? God deliberately moves slowly, but it's a purpose to move forward. I'm convinced that the best kind of growth is slow growth. It's the same way with losing weight. The best way to lose weight is a slow, methodical, not losing it all like that because it'll come right back. And some of you resemble that remark. You know what I'm talking about. You've been on the roller coaster before. It's the slow, steady purpose of going through. So Haman must have thought here at this point, he's really something. He's not only been invited to one banquet, now he's being invited to a second banquet. Man, I'm getting in good here, even with the king's wife. And he's starting to feel pretty good about himself. But what he doesn't realize, again, he's playing this high-stakes game of hangman. And in the next few verses, we're going to see Haman hang himself. And that's what we're working through. Now, if you're taking notes, and I've actually considered doing this to show you today a little PowerPoint of this. But when you play hangman, if you want to do that, you can just draw your gallows, like the old West gallows, with a line up and the line going over to the side, and that's where you're going to put your rope. And so we're building this. The first question I want to ask you is this question: do you have a big head? Do you have a big head? Esther chapter 5, verses 9 through 13, the Bible says, "Then went Haman forth that day joyful, with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he stood not up nor moved for him, he was full of indignation against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman refrained himself, and when he came home, he sent and called for his friends and Zeresh his wife. And Haman told them of the glory of his riches and the multitude of his children and all the king's all the things wherein the king had promoted him and how he had advanced him above the princes and servants of the king. Haman said, moreover, yea, Esther the queen did let no man come in with the king into the banquet that she had prepared but myself, and tomorrow am I invited unto her also with the king. Yet all this availeth me nothing so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." Now, if you think about this right now, the question is do you have not just a head, but do you have a big head? As you can see, he has the big head in this section here. And what we're talking about is we're talking about pride. Now, no, none of us struggle with that, do we? None of us have to battle pride. No, pride is something every one of us really struggle with. And when you think about pride, what does pride do? Pride, number one, counts the chickens before they're hatched. You've heard that old phrase before. A lot of time, we see a proud person and we think, wow, they're so confident. They're so secure in themselves, when actually, folks, the opposite is true. Have you ever thought about that? The opposite is usually true. Usually, pride is a mark of somebody trying to hide insecurity. Someone said that pride is the national religion of hell, again, because Lucifer, Satan himself, bragged in Isaiah 14:14 that he was going to be like God. And so, counting his chickens before they hatched, he launched this rebellion that resulted in him being cast out of heaven. And verse 14, we're going to see that Haman's going to decide to hang Mordecai, and he's so confident that he's actually going to go ahead and begin the construction of the gallows there, even without getting the approval of the king. Pride is going to cause us to plan our lives without consulting the king. James in the New Testament warns us against making plans without God. James chapter 4 verse 13 says this: "Go to now, ye that say today or tomorrow we will go into such a city and continue there a year and buy and sell and get gain, whereas you know not what shall be on the morrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. For that you ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. But now you rejoice in your boastings. All such rejoicing is evil." I don't know if you're like me, but I've discovered that the best laid plans of mice and men are often to no avail. We make our plans and things don't happen the way we planned them to be. I know many times it's like Murphy's Law. Y'all know Murphy's Law? Kind of guarantees, if you think about it, life is basically one big if. In fact, it's right there in the middle of the word. L-I-F-E, you got if right there in the middle of the word itself. Life is full of ifs, and we don't know what's going to happen. There's no guarantee what's going to happen tomorrow. We're on dangerous plans when we start building the gallows, and we don't even have permission yet for this. James tells us to preface all of our planning with the words, "if the Lord wills," and instead of getting our plans together and then saying, "God, here are my plans, I've worked everything out, now make something happen," why don't we ask Him what He wants us to do first? We need to stop praying, "God, bless what I'm doing." Instead, start praying, "Lord, help me to do what You're blessing." Let me say that again. Instead of saying, "Lord, bless what I'm doing," we ought to say, "Lord, help me to do what You're blessing." If you're not doing that, then I think what we're doing is we're presuming upon God, and that's pride. Secondly, pride is going to cloud our vision. And if you're drawing the picture and you've drawn a big old head under the hangman up there, you draw that, you might want to put a couple of eyes there, big old eyes, because pride clouds our vision. Haman was so convinced of his importance that he never dreamed Esther could have anything against him. He was excited about that second banquet. He should have been cautious about that. He'd had this intimate dinner with them. He'd had that banquet with them. And now what's he going to do? He's going to go off. He's going to tell his friends. He's going to tell his family. In fact, if you look at those verses there, he uses a lot of personal pronouns. His friends, his wife, his riches, his sons. By the way, there are 10 of them. This guy was so stuck on himself, he couldn't believe anybody would be out to get him there. But pride is so subtle, folks. It's not a bad idea to listen to yourself every once in a while. Every conversation has to begin with your name, though. That's a problem. When everything has to be about you, you need to check your pride. If you're always demanding your way, I like it this way. I want it this way. I'm going to take my ball and go home. Now, you think that's childish, but no, that's what the kids get from their parents. They're learning that. Pride will cloud our vision. If it's always about you, maybe you need to go back and check your pride. Because like Haman, your pride is causing you to be oblivious to the fact that you're often making more enemies than you're making friends. Pride is a third thing that you're going to see here. It's going to cause our fall. Causes us to be presumptive, causes us to be cocky, and we eventually end up making the big mistake that hangs us, which is kind of interesting because Haman's head is starting to swell like a big old watermelon, and here's the king and the queen of the largest empire on earth discussing a personal matter right in his presence. Ooh, how wonderful I must be. Not only was he the king's confidant, now he's now even privy to the queen's business. And of course, he would come to that banquet the next night, and how could they possibly make a decision without his wise input that is there? Folks, Proverbs 16, verse 18, you all know it. Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. How many of us have done that? How many of us have been there before? You know, you get to that point where you're like, oh yeah, yeah, I can still outjump you. Let me hit that rim. Oops. Okay, you ready to play the game of hangman some more? First question is, do you have a big head? The second question is, do you have a bitter heart? Do you have a bitter heart? Verse 9 tells us that Haman was full of indignation against Mordecai. And another translation says that Haman was furious with Mordecai. It's literally the word that means malice. It means ill will or desire to injure, wickedness, depravity. It's somebody that's not even ashamed to break the laws. Malice is that deep-seated hatred that brings delight if our enemy is suffering and pain if they succeed. Malice is when I want to see somebody hurt. You know, we've been hurt so bad, what she said to me was so cruel, I want to turn around and I want to see her pay. That's malice. New Testament says, let all bitterness and wrath and malice be put away from you. All right, put all of that away and be kind one to another. But malice is the end of that, where not only were you upset, but bitterness will always lead to malice, where you're going to turn around and not only do you want to see them hurt, but if they're successful, that hurts you. And folks, some of us need to check our heart this morning. Because right now, I'm looking at a bunch of people that have been hurt. A lot of you have been offended. A lot of you have been hurt along the way. And that's true. It's going to happen. Now, the Bible talks about malice. 1 Corinthians 5, verse 8, Paul speaks of the leaven of malice. And he compares it to yeast because, like, yeast begins very small, but it gradually grows and finally permeates every corner and crevice of the bread or the dough. It's going to permeate every crevice or corner of your life. This insidious thing about malice is that it has to act. Malice eventually has to express itself. That's what we saw with our friends up in Indiana this past week. Deep-seated bitterness that was growing, that eventually, that everybody saw the warning signs. By the way, it's scary to think about the things that they were noticing. Everybody knew something like that was going to happen because malice has to act. Look at verse 14 of Esther chapter 5. Then said Zeresh his wife and all his friends unto him, let a gallows be made of 50 cubits high, and tomorrow speak thou unto the king that Mordecai may be hanged thereon. Then go thou in merrily with the king unto the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman, and he caused the gallows to be made. So Haman hates Mordecai so much that he builds this gallows. Now, by the way, the gallows that Haman's going to build is a little bit different than what we have here on our little drawing, the old hangman game. The gallows that he's talking about is like a big old stake that they would be impaled on, basically like sitting them on a big stake there that would eventually go up into your body, into the vital organs. It was very, very cruel way to die. In the Hebrew, it's the word es, which literally means a tree or a pole. So it's a death by being impaled. So what we find here, Haman's not wasting time at all. He orders the gallows to be made. It's going to be 50 cubits, or that's 75 feet high. Now that's pretty high, 75 feet up in the air. So he's doing it on a grand scale here. And the execution of this prominent Jew such as Mordecai was going to paralyze the wills of the Jewish people in the empire. And Haman would have them now in his bloody hands. And the plan was perfect except for one thing. Everything was fitting together except for one thing. God standing over here in the shadows. God knows what's going on. God is orchestrating. He's even put his queen in position to be in a place where she can have influence at this time. God is protecting his own. Proverbs chapter 5, verse 21 says this, "For the ways of man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he pondereth all his goings. His own iniquities shall take the wicked himself, and he shall be holden with the cords of his sins. He shall die without instruction, and in the greatness of his folly he shall go astray." I read those verses and I thought, man, that's Haman right there. In the end, the very thing Haman intended to use against his greatest enemy is actually going to turn into an instrument of his own execution, as we're going to see, but we're not going to have time to get into all that today. Luke 17, verse 1, it says, "It is impossible that offenses will come, but woe unto him through whom they come." I want you to notice something about being offended. I said a moment ago, a lot of us have been hurt, a lot of us have been offended. I want to go as far as to say this, all of us have been offended. Because the Bible says right here, it's not a matter of will you be offended at some point in your life, it's a matter of when you will be offended. And if you want to read my lips, you can do that today. Every one of us here today has been or will be offended at one time or another. And if it hasn't happened to you yet, then you probably ought to just check your pulse. Because there's no doubt in my mind that you're going to be offended if you're alive. It may come from a parent. It may come from a family member. It may come from a brother or a sister. It could be a coworker. It could be a fellow church member. Folks, it could be your pastor. But Jesus is warning us, it's going to come. Now, I want to be real brave right now and get each one of us just to think about this. Have you benefit? Are you offended as you sit here today? Is there somebody right now that you can think in your mind that is you're dwelling on? Bitterness has started to take root. And that bitterness is eventually going to lead to the anger and the wrath and eventually to malice if we don't deal with this. And the question is, again, do we have a bitter heart? So the real question becomes, again, what are you going to do when you are offended? Because listen to me very closely again, how you respond to an offense will determine your future, and your not only your future, but the future of a lot of people that are around you. I know this is very personal to some of you here today. Some of you here today know people that have been hurt. They dealt with it the wrong way. They turned it the wrong way. They began to hurt other people. They brought a lot of other people down in the process. A lot of times, folks, the sad thing in all of this, the casualties are our young people. The casualties are our children. I remember being in one particular ministry preaching, and it was a bunch of older folks in the church, but they'd had roast preacher every day. None of their kids wanted to go to church. Kids grew up, they didn't join that church. They went somewhere else. Because there was anger and bitterness and wrath, and they had this bitter heart. And folks, what they were doing is they were setting their church up for hanging. Church was going to die. My question for us today is, is, are you bitter? Because offended people, folks, produce a lot of fruit in their lives. Just like you have the fruit of the Spirit, there is a fruit of bitterness. You have a fruit like hurt, fruit like anger and outrage and jealousy and resentment and strife and envy and even hatred. And some of the consequences of picking up those offenses turn into insults and attacks and division and broken relationships and betrayal and backsliding. And most of the time, the people who are offended don't even realize that they're trapped. It's just like Haman. Some of you here today do not realize how much hurt you're causing. You don't realize what it's done to you. You don't realize what it's doing to other people. You know, sometimes when we're offended, it's the people that hurt us the most are the people we were closest to. Why is it that you find the greatest hatred sometimes among people who are the closest to you at one time? Any lawyer will tell you the most vicious cases they deal with are found in the divorce courts. History is going to show us that the bloodiest wars are civil wars. Brother against brother, son against father, father against son. Now, why is that? And I believe it's because of this. Only a friend can get close enough to really hurt you. You know, we're not really hurt when some guy across town we don't know says something about us. What hurts was when it's somebody that's really close to us. Somebody that we love. And so those kind of offenses sometimes are very, very severe. But what happens is because of that and we've been offended is now we're not able to deal with that and we have these hearts that are bitter and they're hurt. Jesus' words in Luke 17:1, where he uses the word for offend there in the Greek, it's literally the word scandalon in the Greek, which you get the word scandalous from. But originally it referred to a bait on a trap, the bait that was attached to a trap. And what's happened is that bait has been set to the trap and God is going to, or the devil's going to use that trap of offense to somehow cause us to be scandalized or to be caught. 2 Timothy 2:24 says, "And the servant of the Lord must not strive, but be gentle all unto all men, apt to teach, patient and meekness, instructing those that oppose themselves, if God peradventure will give them repentance to the acknowledging the truth, and that they may recover themselves out of the snare of the devil, who were taken captive by him at his will." And that's a picture again that even when you're looking at who your leaders are, they should not be people that have this attitude of offense and bitterness and all of this and constantly be striving as such, because as a result of that, they're going to be taken into captivity or this trap or this scandal on. Now, there are two results of bitterness. The first one is that we begin to blame others. And if you're projecting blame onto others for your hurts, you've already fallen into the trap. And a lot of times when we're offended, we see ourselves as victims. We play the victim. We think somehow somebody has caused us pain. If it wasn't for my parents, that's the way it is. Wasn't for my parents. If I would just have a normal life, it's their fault I am where I am today. You could be 60 years old today, 70 years old, still blaming your parents. I'm Irish. I have red hair, just like my mama. And because she had red hair and she had a bad temper, I have a bad temper. It's their fault. And the list is endless. It's because we want to blame somebody else. Well, Haman was so filled with hatred of the Jews in general, Mordecai in particular, that he couldn't even enjoy talking about his greatness. That was deep bitterness there. He began to justify our bitterness, unforgiveness, and anger. It's their fault. But I want to emphasize this point, folks. Absolutely no man or woman, not even the devil, can force you out of the will of God. That's a choice that you make. That's a choice that you have to make. No one but God Himself holds your destiny, because when we begin to blame others and defend our own position, we're blind to that. We have these blind eyes, just like we were talking about a moment ago. We have this barren heart here. But Jesus says, listen, you get that log out of your own eye. The second result of bitterness is a barren life. Here Haman is bragging to anyone who will listen. He's talking about everything that he has, but then in verse 13 he says, get this, "Yet all this availeth me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." That's pathetic, isn't it? That's pathetic. His rapture turns to rage when he thought of Mordecai. doesn't add to life, this bitterness and malice. It's going to rob you of life, and eventually it's going to suck the life out of you, and by the way, everyone else around you. And the only way to release the noose of bitterness from your heart is going to be forgiveness, letting the bitterness go. And each one of us that know the Lord, we know we can forgive because we've been forgiven. The last question is going to be this question. If you're going to hang yourself, it's going to lead to this. Do you make bad decisions? Because bad advice is going to cause us to make bad decisions. So he goes out, they have this brilliant idea of building this 75-foot-high gallows to impale Mordecai on that. And who's giving him the advice? It's his wife and his friends. He's poisoned their attitude. Now they're giving bad advice. I'll tell you, I've seen it happen time and time again. Somebody's sitting around, they're talking about so-and-so. They're talking about their boss. They're talking about this position of authority, their teacher or whatever. They get to talking. Somebody else starts talking. Everything is one-sided. We don't know both sides of the story. It's all heard one, you know, from one position, one perspective. And now all of a sudden, we're giving bad advice. We're getting bad advice, and we're digging ourselves into a deeper hole. It's funny, you listen to people sometimes again, and they're talking about their issue. For example, he's complaining about his boss. That John Holmes is such a slave driver down there. You know, they're complaining about their boss and all, and all of a sudden everybody in their family hates the boss down there and thinks he's just so cruel. But the guy doesn't tell his family that he's lazy. Doesn't tell the family that he's coming in late or he's leaving early. I know that doesn't happen at Chick-fil-A, but I mean in the real world. That's just like human nature. We end up making bad decisions. I'm sure Haman here in his twisted mind, he's the innocent little lamb being persecuted and being maligned by evil Mordecai. You know, it's so easy. I talk to people. They're having marriage problems or they've been divorced and their ex was just like the Antichrist. And we forget it takes two to tango. At least that's what Geico told me on that commercial I saw. It's easy to make the person confronting you look like the vicious, malicious, rude person. You know, when parents correcting the child, you know, the child turns around. Without thinking that maybe there's something better at play here, we want to turn around and make the parents to be the bad guys. A big head, a bitter heart, bad decisions, they're going to all hang you every time. And Haman's options were up, and like we used to say when the stick figure was complete, hangman, for Haman, the game was almost over here. And this morning we've gotten really practical about some things. I've asked you, what about your pride? Is it all about you? Is it all about you? You know, folks, God's providence will give you a good perspective on pride, on your pride. Pride very quickly can lead to bitterness. I didn't get my way. I didn't like that. I didn't like the way that happened. That should have been done differently. And it becomes more about us. I really think in a church setting, for example, I think people have a little bit better intentions than sometimes some of us treat others. You know, things happen. You know, somebody has a flat tire, they don't make it when they should be there, when they were supposed to do something, or something happens, and it's not that they're out to get you and hurt you and make it difficult. You know, you know what I'm saying. What happens? Pride, bitterness began to come in, and then we receive bad decisions. In all of these instances, what happens is we begin to hang ourselves. The words of Psalm 7, verse 14 to 16 make me think of Haman. Listen to what this says. Behold, he travaileth with iniquity and hath conceived mischief and brought forth falsehood. He made a pit and digged it and is fallen into the ditch which he made. His mischief shall return upon his own head, and his violent dealing shall come down upon his own pate. There's a what we might call a law of retribution in this world. You've heard it. What goes around comes around. Well, that's about what's going to happen right now. Haman didn't realize this, but it's like someone once wrote, Though the mills of God grind slowly, yet they grind exceeding small. Though with patience he stands waiting, with exactness grinds he all. And Haman doesn't realize, but three forces here had already begun to work together to destroy him. And my question for us today, are those three forces possibly working in your life, in your family, in your church? That's your pride. That's your bitterness. That's the failure to follow wise advice. We're making bad decisions. To avoid judgment, we have to do just simply one thing, and that's repent, change the direction of our life, forgive, stop trying to get revenge through our anger and our actions. You know what? I believe that there are people in here this morning that are going through tough times right now simply because this is what goes around comes around. Some of you right now are struggling in relationships and other things, and at the root of it, rather than getting out here trying to blame everybody else, like you're trying to pick the fruit off a tree somewhere, you need to get down to the root of your problem, and the root of the problem is not out there. The root of the problem is right here. And when we begin to take ownership of our own issues and our own problems, now all of a sudden there's hope. Now what I'm giving you here today is something that you can take out of here and you can apply it right to your church and your family. But folks, the message here today is even more practical than just that. You can take that with you to your neighbor. You can take that with you to your place of business, to that person and that issue or whatever you're facing. You have to humble yourself. You become the servant. You do just like Jesus did, denying yourself the ability to have. You know, Jesus was God, but he laid aside all of that and became a servant, washed the feet of disciples that were arguing over which one of them was the greatest when he was the greatest. They're arguing over that, and Jesus goes off and knowing that even they're going to betray him, they're going to turn their backs on him. He's serving them. You take the high road. You let everybody else go out there, and when people are out here being a part of this pattern like Haman was, setting themselves up for a game of hangman where they're about to hang themselves, you hang in there. Not on the gallows, but you hang in there and be what you're supposed to be. You take a stand for what is right. You see, this is incredibly practical what we're looking at right now. Because the bottom line is this, there are gallows that are being built today. And I don't want to see a single one of us in here hang ourselves. But if you end up being hanged, you have nobody to blame but yourself. Nobody. It's not your parents' fault. It's not your boss's fault. It's not your preacher's fault. Not your wife's fault or husband's fault. Nobody to blame but yourself. And we're going to see as we work our way further through this, and I'm excited as we look at this, and we're going to have to save this for a little bit. We'll come back to this when we do. We're going to see how God is using Esther and changing Mordecai, and God is going to end up punishing Haman because of these poor choices. You go ahead, take the time to work your way through it. Let's just be in much prayer that God would work in hearts and lives spiritually today.